Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is a new one to Real GM Radio, but not a new one to Real GM, and that is Keith Smith, my former colleague at Real GM, who now works for Spotrac, Celtics blog, and then he does the front office show, podcast / YouTube show. And we have a really fun conversation going through kind of how we each have been not only processing the 22 offseason, but also how front offices work, the cap spike, or revenue increase that may be coming in 2025 or thereabouts, and a lot of other stuff. A really fun podcast, well over an hour, a lot of great substance here, and it is brought to you by betonline.ag. Use that CLNS50 promo code for a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. And yeah, I think I had a lot of fun with this. I hope you will as well. Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. You and I have known each other for years, and yet it's good to kind of talk in this forum as opposed to the other ones that we do. And I think the place to start, I'll open the floor to you, and if you want to cede it back to me because you have to think about this longer than I already have, is do you have any kind of like broad scale, bigger takeaways from the offseason so far?
I think the kind of the theme for me was flexibility. I think teams tried to keep flexibility for the best part as much as they could within season, whether that was let's avoid the tax, let's avoid becoming hard capped. And then long-term flexibility, I think a lot of teams are positioning themselves to make runs maybe in the next year or so as the cap continues to go up and contracts seem like they've relatively stabilized and those kind of things. So I think we've got a lot of teams that are really trying to put themselves in positions to be flexible to pivot in whatever direction they want to be versus necessarily locking in. And then within that, of course, you had the handful of teams that are basically saying, hey, now's our chance. We're going to load up and go for it, like Boston, Milwaukee, Denver, the Clippers, those types of teams. I think, which is good to see because I think the league feels a little more wide open than it has felt in a number of years.
It does. And the ripples of having two teams that are at least two that were very injured last year that expect to be in the mix. So it's like, okay, the Warriors and the Celtics are still going to be there. And the Celtics, you know, added Brogdon, and age related progression and everything like that. I think they'll be good. And so, but then you add in these other teams in the mix and you get the hypothetical of, well, where would a healthy Nuggets team have fared last year? Where would a healthy Clippers team have fit in last year? And that, all of that fitting together is going to be absolutely fascinating. So I wholeheartedly agree with that. And there's also like this idea, and this will tie in with something I'm going to get to in a second, that broadly speaking, I think teams are meaningfully better run now than they were. If we want to go back even like 30 years or 20 years, where the idea being that there's a theory behind what's going on a vast majority of the time. Sure, there will be moves, there will be overall strategies that I disagree with, but it's not like a couple of GMs or owners know what they're doing and then they just bludgeon everybody else because everybody else has no idea.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. I did an article for SpotTrack, which was identifying the 10 worst value contracts contracts of the offseason, and it was really hard to find 10 this year. That used to be a very simple exercise to go find 10 of them, and now it's a far more difficult thing to do. And I think what is interesting is what one of the ones that maybe the most head-scratching contract for me was DeAndre Jordan, and it's a minimum deal, so who really cares? It's not that big of a thing. So yeah, absolutely. I think it is one of those things now where teams are just so much smarter about the way they lock in. And even the ones I disagree with, I don't necessarily love the Bradley Beal contract, but I understand it. I totally get why Washington is there. There's very few where I look at it and I am struggling and ultimately, searching for someone to explain to me why it made sense.
Right. And along those lines, I have been lower on Marvin Bagley than a vast majority of people, and Troy Weaver is higher on Marvin Bagley than I am. But I think that the overall kind of getting a bunch of bigs who can't shoot for the Pistons isn't something I love, but it's it's not an indefensible move. I think it's an overpay, but again, we're within, if you think about it as standard deviations from the curve, we're not as far off as we used to be, and some of that is just the nature of who is free agents. Also that there weren't that many teams with cap space. So the capacity for what happened in 2016 just wasn't there. There weren't teams just sitting out there going, crap, we have this money. Here you go, Mozgov. Here you go, Evan Turner. It's a fundamentally different world. But at the same point, nobody was doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's it. Those are the three deals. You mean Mozgov, Evan Turner, and then Luol Deng. Those are the three that are kind of still, here we are 6 years later, and those are kind of the ones we're still pointing to as, nothing like that happened. And that just kind of makes me chuckle a little bit because it's true. We're not in a position where we're sitting with those kind of things now. And I think even the teams that are let's say, poor teams, rebuilding teams, or just straight up bad teams, they're no longer, I think, fully feeling the pressure of, we have to go sign player X because we have to try to win more games this year. I think there's more of an acceptance for if we're bad, it is what it is. As long as there's some, theory here, as long as there is a plan, then we can live with this. And I think fans in general have gotten better about understanding those things. And I think teams have become a lot more transparent about explaining those kind of things to their fans as far as, hey, here's what we're doing, here's what the goals are, versus kind of, hinting around it. Nobody's coming out and saying, look, we're trying to be terrible, we're going to lose as many games, but they say it in a way that makes sense. And I think fans buy into that. And that makes it a lot easier when you do kind of take that rebuilding path.
It does. And there's also the element that as long as it's not forever, following a rebuilding team can actually be pretty fun. The extremes of the process Sixers and some of those other, that can be tough. If you're obviously going to be bad, you're going to lose a lot. But you could say, for example, the Houston Rockets. The Rockets this year, I'm not expecting them to win a ton of games, but they have players that if you're a Rockets partisan, even if they don't win a lot of games this year, you're going to see a lot of Jalen Green. You're going to see a lot of Jabari. You're going to see a lot of the billion for rookie scale guys that they have over the last couple of years. And so, you don't necessarily want to be in that boat for 5 years and just kind of see it all stagnate. And there will be times that the players that you think are going to rise are going to be the rising tide just aren't. It can happen. It will happen somewhere. But that there is merit to that approach. And you brought up the idea of kind of teams getting more okay with it. And I know one closer to your backyard like that is the Orlando Magic. And the Magic were in this boat. They were in this mold for a while of, being in the playoff mix, but not really making a lot of noise. They did win. They won some games and everything else like that. And then they sold off some of those players, got a pretty significant return for most of them. And then now they're building up the coffers again. And Paolo looked very fun in summer league, and hopefully Suggs can have a better second year than his first year. And again, that's as a fan base, it's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you here in Orlando, Orlando's a little bit of a weird place. There's not a lot of people from here.
Sure.
Which is very different. There are so many transplants. Like myself, I grew up in Massachusetts and moved here, and there's a lot of other people like that. So it's been at times hard because the Magic become kind of, they're the local team. That's where I can go to watch NBA games. But then it is is, all right, well, when they're good, we'll attach to them and people do get behind them. Now that is changing as, people like my daughter grow up and people slightly older than her, they grew up as Magic fans. So that is changing. There is a pretty good core group of fans. But what's very interesting is people were super excited when they made the playoffs a few years ago because it was the first time they'd made it in several years. But then when that turned into, all right, are we going any further the next year? And that got kind of ruined by the pandemic and the bubble season and all that. But by the time we were in that third year, and it was like, all right, maybe they can keep pushing to be a, in the play-in mix. I think people were like, all right, but it's never going to be better than that. We're always going to be somewhere in the 7 to 10 range with this group. Now people are energized and beyond excited to see this team. And that's, I think, a credit to them because they were very forthright, Jeff Weltman and John Hammond, with here is our plan. We're going to build through youth. We're going to build through the draft. We're going to try to re-sign players when we acquire them and all those kind of things. And I think that's very important because they were out there right from the front, right from the start, rather, selling this plan to the fans and getting them on board and getting them excited. And now everyone is. Everybody, I know more people who are Magic fans that are way more excited about this team than they were the team that made the playoffs 2 years in a row.
Right. And it makes some sense. And what you brought up in terms of like, where does it go from here? I always think of as the line of delineation, where if there is a reason, maybe it's because you have young players or you could change your coach or something else to think we can actually win a playoff series or maybe even two or three. Like that is really exciting. And tearing that down without a good reason is frustrating. But I've long believed, and there are owners, there are general managers who vehemently disagree with me, like Ted Leonsis, for example, that the being in the mix for the 8th seed, just, I think of that as personally, as a fan, the least fun place to be. And that's, like Kevin Pritchard coined the term, I'm working on a piece about this, at the treadmill of mediocrity. And like, that's how I define it. It's like you're, and sometimes those teams, even like, I had this criticism of the Spurs the last couple of years before now, and I will heap praise on them in a second, of that, where your best case scenario, if we're being honest about it, is losing in the first round. Like maybe there's a 5% chance that you break through and you get that win, maybe because the other team has an injury or like you play really, really well and then you get knocked out in the second round. I personally, I'm a fan of teams in other sports. I personally don't love that. Let's say in baseball, like you're a wild card team, but then you're probably not going to like make the league championship series or the World Series. Like, I mean, it's fine. They're like, in individual seasons, there are worse places you can be. And so I'm thrilled to see teams push one direction or the other. And the Spurs are a good example of that. And then the other one, thank you, Danny Ainge, is the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Utah, I think one of the things that's important too that I always say with this is I think it's insulting when you hear people throw around things of that fan base can't stomach a rebuild.
Agreed.
It's so insulting to fans. I think as long as you have an actual plan and it goes somewhere and it's not a 10-year rebuild, because that's not a rebuild, that's a failure, then I think fans are fine with it. I think as long as you can sell a plan, and you're spot on with Utah, because I think we're sitting here now, right, and as we record this, we're still waiting on a Donovan Mitchell trade, which is bananas here in the beginning part of August. But I feel like that is going to happen eventually. And I think this is Danny Ainge doing what he did twice in Boston, which is, hey, we're going to tear this down. We're not going to go part way. We're going to tear it down as far as we can. We're going to get everything we can, and we're going to start all over. We're going to start basically from scratch as much as is possible for a non-expansion team. And we're going to move forward that way. And I think that's good. And I see now my interactions with Jazz fans, seeing them interact with their beat writers and that, they seem more kind of energized and excited about what might be versus, all right, another year of we're a good regular season team and we're out earlier than we wanted to be in the playoffs. And I think, having that courage and also that willingness and that support from ownership to say, let's turn that direction, that's huge for a franchise. Because if you have an owner that's going to say, to your point, which there are still a couple of, no, but let's just compete to get in the playoffs every year, then probably your ceiling is just getting into the playoffs every year.
Yeah, unless you can, through that process, get the star that can be the best player in a series beyond that. And that's harder to get. Like, that's a part of the point you're making, is that it's harder to get those players when you're never getting the pick equity and you're, you know, typically you're spending a lot of money, so you don't get that kind of flexibility either. Like, it's actually more likely that you will get that next star by going in one direction or the other rather than being in the middle. And along those lines, something else that, and I think fans, as you mentioned, are getting more discerning, that makes what the Spurs and the Jazz chose to do more palatable, is that they got very strong returns for their star players that they've sent out. And we'll see what the Jazz get for Mitchell, assuming a trade happens. It has not, as we're recording this. But, you know, in my opinion, the Jazz got an absolute haul for Rudy Gobert. You know, they got Walker Kessler, who's already there, and then unprotected picks in 23 and 25, an unprotected swap in 26, and then there's also 27 and 29. Like, so 29 is lightly protected. And so, like, for them, it's, you know, that's a lot of equity. And then the Hawks, I think they got three firsts for DeJounte. And so not only is it like, okay, we moved in this direction that we probably should have moved in anyway, but we got a lot to do it. And there also are some models now, and the Celtics are at the front of this line, of teams that did this and it worked. And it's something I think about a lot. The NBA is, we think of it as a copycat league at the top, because it is, but it's also a copycat league at the bottom, where the idea is that if you think about how other teams have succeeded, and then you go, well, can we do something like that? And there's no guarantee that, I mean, it's far from a guarantee, I expect the opposite in the near term, that the picks Utah got for Gobert are going to be as good as what eventually became Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, that is a top tier outcome, both in terms of the selections they got and the players they eventually chose. But the idea that having a lot of equity in another team's future can work out really well is a useful thing for, like, kind of selling your owner, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things I think that worked for Boston was clearly through some player acquisition. I think Brad Stevens came in as maybe a better coach than anybody thought he would be initially, right out of the gate. They ended up being better, faster than I think anyone could have guessed. But then what was kind of fun during that period was they then, what I was calling, they outsourced their tank, because they were able to be good and their picks could end up in the 20s, which many of them did, because they had all these other really good picks coming from Brooklyn. Now, I don't necessarily expect that to happen with Minnesota, because I think they're younger. I think they're more built for at least near-term sustainable success than that Nets team was. I think Danny Ainge in a lot of ways read it correctly with the Nets of, yeah, we're trading you older players to add to already older injury-prone players that you have. And it all fell apart on Brooklyn in spectacular fashion. It delivered great picks to the Celtics. But that's the thing, is you can be, because when you have all this extra draft equity that you're kind of sitting on, you can be, you can kind of say, all right, well, if we get good quick, we can lean on that and be good moving forward, because we're going to get this other good stuff from somebody else down the line, maybe, or at least we're going to have extra stuff.
You're gonna have a chance
to work with down the line. Exactly.
And I think that it could potentially, we haven't seen this too much yet, it could tie in with lottery reform, where you're not necessarily asking for the Hawks, or let's say what the Pelicans have from the Lakers. You're not asking for them to be one of the five worst teams in the league. Like, that's, mm-hmm. you know, it can happen. It's not super likely. But if it's the, you know, the slight things go slightly wrong and it's the 10th worst record, and then you have a, you know, I don't know, I can't remember the odds that well, but like, I don't know, a 15% chance of getting a top four pick, especially if you have this unprotected, that could end up being awesome. And like, and that's, it's a path there. And so having that be a little bit more balanced can work out well. And I think that also ties in with something that is going to loom over the remaining negotiations. And by that, I mean the Donovan Mitchell trade stuff and potentially KD and or Kyrie, especially KD, is I like to think of the Paul George trade in particular as kind of a perfect storm, where it was a team that had extra resources, primarily from the Tobias Harris trade, that had a clear urgency to do it because Kawhi Leonard said, I'm coming if you get Paul George. And so you had this absolute haul that went from the Clippers to the Thunder. And while I think the Clippers overpaid, I we were talking about before with contracts, I understand the overpay because you're in some ways you're getting Kawhi Leonard for what you paid for Paul George. Sam Presti had a hilarious amount of leverage in that circumstance. But there aren't teams right now, as we're recording this, that I think have both of those, both of the elements there, which were a resource that, like, you know, like this bevy of picks, especially if you have some that aren't your own, because that makes things easier, and a motivation to put those chips in. So, like, there are teams that have one of the two, like the Pelicans, like the Oklahoma City Thunder, but they don't have the second. Like, this is not the time for OKC to throw in for KD or for Donovan Mitchell or something else. Like, that's, it's not the right place. And, you know, Houston has all these Brooklyn picks, which might be getting juicier incidentally through a Kevin Durant trade. And so what happens is, I think that the Nets saw the Gobert trade and, you know, and you could say Drew Holiday and all these other ones went, well, I mean, Durant's a better player. Durant's on a more, you know, even though he's older, he's on a, you know, you could say comparatively, he's on a better contract. And so it changed their sights. And then the other thing that shifts things for the Nets is the status quo, assuming Kevin Durant isn't going to pull a James Harden, is actually pretty palatable. Like, it's not a circumstance like the Jazz. Like, you could argue that the best thing that could happen to the Brooklyn Nets is keeping this all together and being in the mix next year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why this one is, whenever people ask me, you know, why hasn't a Kevin Durant trade happened? And it's, my answer is always, well, it's really complicated. It's hard to trade Kevin Durant because, especially when the market to some extent got thrown out of whack with the Rudy Gobert trade, because if you're the Nets, it's hard to take back less, but it's also you're in a position where, all right, well, where are we going? And I think that becomes easier to answer, where we'll find out. I mean, there's all sorts of reporting out there that Kevin Durant is meeting with the Nets and these kind of things. And if that turns into, hey, we'll still stay open to a trade, but I'm going to be there and I'm going to be ready to play, then if I'm the Nets, I'm going to look at it and be like, all right, well, if we trade Kevin Durant, it's probably in our best interest to say, all right, well, let's see, you know, where we go from here. And, you know, I know we owe some picks to Houston in the future, but that's, you know, sunk cost. And, you know, maybe we figure out, you know, a different way. And we almost look like we did after the Boston trade. But if Kevin Durant's back, they're what, probably top 5, 6, 7 team in the league, assuming health and other things. So that turns into a whole different story. And that's why it is so complicated with that one. I also think, too, your point of teams reading and saying, is it the right time? That's also, I think, a place where teams have gotten a lot better at, is saying, all right, you know, it felt like for years for me watching as a fan, and then even early on when I was covering the league, it turned into, all right, well, we did the rebuild thing and now we're in year two of this rebuild and it was a really bad year. And all right, we got to start moving things forward because everybody's going to lose their patience. Now it feels like teams are like, no, we're not ready yet. We're going to, you know, let's funnel minutes to the kids. Let's give them roles. Let's keep going with this. And that feels like it's a very big difference versus before, where it was like, we got to go. We got to move up the ladder quicker than this. And I think that's where teams are reading those trends, markets, whatever you want to call it, a little bit smarter and saying it's not time to cash in just yet, because we're going to hang on and we're going to go. And then, you know, again, then you have you're always going to have the one or two. Minnesota did it this year and kind of cashed in and said, hey, we want to make this a sustainable thing. But I fully get it for them, because this is a team that's made the playoffs twice since Kevin Garnett was traded in 2008, so well over a decade. That is a, or I guess 2007 he was actually traded. So that is a whole other thing. And for them is, hey, you know, maybe being in the playoffs and giving ourselves a chance to climb up the ladder, that's a whole different world for them to play in. So that's where you can kind of look at it again, going back to what we said off the top. It's maybe not the direction I would have taken, but I at least understand why they took that direction.
Agreed. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that like one of the instructional examples there, and it's funny because like, you know, Nate and I have been recording long enough that we've talked about it. And I mean, I wrote for Real GM long enough too, is thinking about the way that the Pelicans responded to Anthony Davis being awesome. And so they, you know, what happened is Anthony Davis, number one pick, we all thought he was going to be really good. He ends up being great. The response was, okay, let's get good right now. And so they had the sixth pick in the draft that year and they eventually traded that and a few others for Drew Holiday. And then they also eventually got Omer Asik as well. And Drew Holiday was young. Like Drew Holiday was a good young player, you know, kind of mm-hmm. more in the vein of what the Hawks did with DeJounte, but being impatient, focusing more on Anthony Davis's pre-prime rather than his actual prime was simultaneously like understandable, but also the wrong decision because A, he's under team control and he's going to get better. But also when you short circuit that process, there's no way to replicate it other than incredible drafting or signing. Like it's you can't manufacture that a different way, you know, building up those draft picks, getting that equity because of the way the soft cap works, because of the way players are available. If your picks become worse, if you burn a bunch of those picks to get established players, you're never getting them back. And so you need, as well as Drew Holiday played for New Orleans, you need all of those things to work in order for it to be a real success. And I think that's something teams have learned from a few of those missteps.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the Pelicans, because then I think about when they traded Anthony Davis, they almost repeated it, but almost too preemptively, because they traded Anthony Davis. They, at the point that they knew, all right, we're going to get Zion, and health issues, you know, aside, I think they rightly read Zion's going to be awesome when he plays. But then it was, let's try to be great right now. And it was, let's spend a lot of money on JJ Redick. Let's go trade for Derek Favors. Let's do all these things. And this all happened before we even saw Zion play a game. And I think then it was, you tried to do too much too quick. And they got, now Zion getting hurt obviously didn't help things, but they did get a little stuck there for like a year or two, where it was, all right, now we got to kind of work around this, because you know what, Derek Favors isn't great with Zion. He's just, quite frankly, he's not great anymore anyway. And we have JJ Redick starting to slow down, and all these things that happen with them. And that's where it's that threading that needle between, you know, is it time or isn't it time? I also think there's a point too where, and I made this point in an article on SpotTrack, is you got to be careful of having too much of a good thing. And I use the Thunder as the example here, where it sounds awesome to have 100 extra draft picks until you got to start using them all.
Yeah.
Because you can't trade them. And they ran into that a couple years ago when they were trying to move up in the draft, and they couldn't because everybody was like, I don't want this Pistons pick that's either never going to convey, or when it does finally convey, it's not going to be any good. You don't want to trade the actual good picks you have. So they just got kind of stuck. Now they did it this year. They're able to send, I think it was what, 3 firsts, right? For the pick that they got with the Knicks trade. But then you look at their roster construction. I'm looking at their roster right now. They have 15 players on guaranteed contracts, plus, or I guess 16 on guaranteed contracts now. So you're going to have to cut a guaranteed player. Not the end of the world, but they already had to do that with Isaiah Roby earlier this year, who I think is at least an interesting young player. They're going to have to do it again in a year or two when more of these draft picks are coming home to roost. And everybody says, well, you can just overpay, you know, send a million picks. But they found that out. Boston found that out too when they tried to move up a couple times of, hey, you know, it sounds good that you can send, here's 20 picks, but if they're not 20 really good picks, nobody really wants them. So that's where you got to have this balance. And that's where I think, we'll find out what the Jazz do when they, you know, if and when they ultimately trade Donovan Mitchell. Are they going to be the next team to put themselves in that spot? Because they're you know, the one truth we know, at least today under this CBA that remains, you have 15 standard roster spots, and that's it every year. So it doesn't matter if you bring in seven, you know, good players via the draft, you're going to be sitting there looking at that plus the, all the players you have from the prior year and saying, all right, somebody's got to go. And that's where those really difficult decisions start coming in. And that's how you end up losing, I hesitate to say good players or real difference makers, but at least interesting players for nothing, like the Thunder did with Isaiah Roby.
Like the Thunder did with Roby. And you also eventually, it's mostly a good problem, but you run into the question of all these guys are going to eventually get raises. And
yes,
it can sometimes happen quickly. And that's the other huge problem with a slow rebuild. And the Thunder aren't necessarily there, especially if Shea can have a healthy year. I like Lu Dort quite a bit. If you get into the extension negotiation window or even restricted free agency, and you're still not exactly sure either how good that player is or where they fit into your team, it can be really thorny, because then you're like, well, crap, because those are contracts that can turn sour at some point. It's like, oh, well, you know, they haven't been good for us. Or maybe it's even like you let go and then all of a sudden you didn't fully appreciate what they could be. And so those are both frustrating for fans, for everything. It's like, oh, we let this guy go and then they were good. And I mean, like, again, how they're going to deal with Darius Bazley and Ty Jerome, like those guys are extension eligible right now. They're restricted if you make them qualifying offers next year, but yeah, there might be a chance with the volume of players that OKC's bring in. And some of that is that some of those guys have worked out, you know, like you got a Lu Dort. And so Lu Dort's taking a starter spot, a roster spot from one of, you know, from somebody else, whether it's a rookie scale or a second rounder or anything like that. And also, like, for example, this year, if we're talking about, you know, the Thunder being better, they had so many roster spots and they were kind of close to the tax that they're not using the mid level. I don't think there was anyone they could have used it on, but it's again, it's sure. Like they had to forego an opportunity to add somebody, justifiably so, because where was that person going to play? But, you know, it's again, it's like they sacrificed that, just like when they traded, I think that was 34 and 36 for 31, something yep. wild like that, when they got Robinson Earl. It's like, those are the types of deals that happen sometimes.
I want to say one quick thing too, because I think Boston is instructional here, where there was this fear from the fans of, they're going to trade Romeo Langford, and what if he ends up great? They're going to trade Aaron Nesmith, which they did this summer, and what if he ends up great? And I think the reality is, if those guys end up great, how do you pay them anyway?
Right.
Because you've already got Tatum on a max deal. You got Jaylen Brown on a near max deal, closing in on what will likely be a max deal. You've paid Marcus Smart. You paid Robert Williams. Just those guys together, you're already there. So I look at it as, maybe those guys do end up popping, but getting Malcolm Brogdon, getting Derek White. Derek White obviously was a big part of getting them to the NBA Finals. Now they hope Brogdon helps them take the next step, obviously. But it is, that's the risk you have to be willing to take, is maybe these guys will pop and end up great, but we hope what we traded them for lifts us to where maybe those guys would have got us to. And that's what you have to be willing to do, because, yeah, that was the point I made probably a million times. I remember I wrote something for Celtics blog years ago when I was like, let's look 10 years down the line. And it's the best case scenario is all these guys are awesome, and now you have the most expensive team we've ever seen, which is kind of sort of what's happened with the Warriors. Not exactly, but it's, yeah, when you hit on all these picks, that sounds great. But then when they all need paid, then it starts turning into whole other things you have to factor in and consider eventually anyway.
Along those lines, there the other, and I'll be, it's funny because I'm not the biggest fan of Kobe Altman all the time. I think he's made some things I really liked and some that I didn't. That as another lesson, then the Cavs are a great example of this, is that being optimistic about the players that you have should not prevent you from taking who you think is the best prospect, even if they overlap. Because think about what would have happened if the Cavs saw Colin Sexton's rookie year and said, well, we shouldn't take Darius Garland, even if we think Garland is the number one guy that is available to us. So I'll run through the players that end up being taken immediately after Darius Garland. Jarrett Culver, Kobe White, Jackson Hayes, Rui Hachimura, Cam Reddish. And
that's tough.
It's tough. And I mean, some of those guys could end up reviving themselves, sure. Could end up doing it. Like Jackson Hayes really showed some stuff last year. Hachimura had such a weird season. But I mean, Ainge with Tatum is another great example of this. And it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes your board is just wrong. Sure. But the lesson to me with the Garland pick is, if you think a player is best, then you hope for the good problem, but you don't expect it. Like, until I've always said, you don't draft, like, the only time that I wouldn't draft over the top of a player, it's on the ends of the positional thing, so it's ones and fives. If you already knew, and underline bold knew, that player was great and that they wouldn't fit together. So, mm-hmm. if you have, I don't know, if you have, like, Ja Morant, and then the best part, but even then, I wouldn't step outside of that tier. Like, that's just the way that I've always approached it. And so, and generally speaking, when teams have done that, it's worked out. But when they, like, I mean, there was a story with that with Josh Jackson, if memory serves, where it was, like, part of the motivation for taking Josh Jackson was that the Kings didn't want to overlap with, was that Fox? I guess it was. Oh, no. So Josh Jackson was with the Suns. They didn't want to overlap with their point guards,
yeah.
who then ended up leaving, like, or yeah. trading away. And so I think that's a part of it. Plenty more to talk about with Keith, but first a message from betonline.ag. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports, contests, and events with first-to-market odds and lines. Find reviews and news of every league, including Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, NHL, combat sports, esports, and even golf. BetOnline continues to be the top online resource for all of your sports information, from live in-game betting, props, and futures. So use the promo code CLNS50 to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. It's fantastic. So again, head to the website today or use your mobile device to join, make your first sports bet, and use that CLNS50 promo code to receive your 50% welcome bonus and tell them you came from us. So check out BetOnline, where the game starts. The other thing I wanted to talk about with you is, and this I think is going to be, my instinct is, a lingering story for the next couple of years, is the diminished value / utility of cap space. And there are exceptions, but, you know, like, I think the Knicks, as of right now, are pretty happy with how they did with getting not only Jalen Brunson, but also Isaiah Hartenstein. And then they were able to, you know, get Mitchell Robinson on top of that due to his low cap hold and bird rights. But there are a couple different reasons why this is the case. So one, free agent classes have gotten weaker, not only in terms of the names, but also in terms of what I call the practically available names. So, like, you could say, for example, this year, Beal, LaVine, Harden, in some order, were probably the three best players to hit unrestricted free agency this year. From what mm-hmm. we can tell, none of them really considered any yep. other destination. So yes, they were on the market, but were they really on the market? No. So that's one big factor there. So it's hard to improve. The other one, and this, I was thinking about it this morning when, you know, we were working through what I wanted to talk about with you, is how that part of it affects the other part, which is the value that these cap space teams can generate as facilitators. So whether you want to think about, like, the Jimmy Butler deal, or any number of other ones over the last few years, where it's like Team A really wants Player A, but they need something to make it happen. Team B doesn't want the players that Team A has. How do you make this work? And it's by using another team, typically one that has cap space. But if there are no players on the market that those teams are, you know, moving heaven and earth for, then the cap space teams don't have the leverage they used to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to be a big believer in push for cap space all the time, just because it's going to give you the most optionality going into an offseason. And now it almost feels like it's not as bad to be sitting on, as long as they're not bad contracts, sitting on some money, because teams aren't as opposed to, well, that guy's get an extra year, because I think everybody realized we can just keep moving players. And some guys, you know, we've seen it. Some guys become, they're almost mercenaries through trade, because they just keep getting traded every couple of seasons. And then I think it used to be, too, is to your point on the free agent market, it used to be, all right, teams would look at it and they'd say, 2 years from now, LeBron James is a free agent, going to start everything we're going to do for the next 2 years is going to be around, we're going to chase LeBron James in free agency. And we saw, I think, a little bit of that happen with a couple of teams in the last couple of years, like with Giannis, for example. And then Giannis signed an extension, and then those teams were left with, all right, what do we do? Now that's where you got to be ready to pivot and ready to go into whatever the next thing is. We're going right into that, and off we go, because if you're not, you're going to get stuck. And that's what I think the extension rules changing enough to make signing extensions a viable thing for a lot of players has changed things. And then to your point, it's that actually available, because I kept going through when people would say leading up to this offseason, all right, tell me who the best available free agents are. And I would say, okay, well, I'm glad you said available, because technically this guy's a free agent, but I don't really know that he's necessarily available. And that's where I would take a handful of guys off the list. And that's where, you know, this year, in a lot of ways, I think truly the best available free agent was probably Jalen Brunson. And Jalen Brunson's not even, for me, an all-star tier level guy as far as free agents go. So that's where it becomes, you know, hey, what are we gearing up for if we save all this cap space? Because what are we going to do? Yes, you can be facilitators. Yes, you can be, you don't have to always, you know, I repeat this, you know, ad nauseum. You don't have to always use cap space in a signing. It can be used in a trade, but those are pretty few and far between that those actually go down that way. And I think there's almost no better lesson. And now they're not trying too hard to get guys, but we have two teams here at the beginning of August sitting on basically $30 million of cap space each, which that never would have happened as recently as a couple of years ago, because if nothing else, they would have used that as taking on money to help facilitate a trade. And now teams are just finding other ways to get that done.
They're finding other ways to get that done. And also, so you think about how this can change. And so one part of it is, and I've written about this a little bit and want to do more, that there aren't as many teams desperate to clear big sums of money. Some of that is because there are these aggressive spending teams that aren't doing that. You know, like, for example, if the Clippers were owned by somebody different, first of all, they wouldn't have everything they have. But secondly, like maybe somebody like Luke Kennard, you'd be like, okay, Luke Kennard is functionally costing the Clippers, I believe, more than $50 million. If you want to think about it, and I mean, sure. I don't think about it this way because of the idea that everyone contributes to the luxury tax believably. But trading Luke Kennard theoretically into cap space would save the Clippers, let's call it something like $50 million. It might even be more than that, given how deep they are into the tax. So that, you know, that would be very valuable to certain teams, but Ballmer doesn't care. And so you have that group that's getting out. Then the other thing is there aren't that many other teams that are deep in. You know, you'll have the Blazers. Like, I think the Blazers are going to clear a couple of guys to get under. And you're going to have, you know, there are all these teams that are like $3 and $4 million. And so do that. But also, like, but the question is, are they going to give up real assets to make that happen? No, I don't think they are. And like I was just working on a piece with Will Guillory about the Pelicans. And there will be a point, whether it is this offseason or next one, where moving Devontae Graham makes a lot of sense for them because they're so close to the tax. Like theoretically, if they had done that this year, if they had been able to trade him for nothing, they could have used the mid-level exception. Again, mm-hmm. I don't know who it would have been, partially because this free agent class is so bad. Similar story next year. But next year, that could be you move Graham so that you can retain either Hayes or Nance. And like, if you think those guys are better, then you could do that. Hopefully you can find another backup point guard. So you'll have those sorts of circumstances. But the Pelicans, for that privilege, they're not going to give you like a really good first round pick or something. Like maybe they'd give up a late first that they knew what it was going to be and it had you knew what number it was going to be, so it didn't have like that real upside of what happens the next season. But even then, I think they'd be trying to get a good player back if they were going to do that. Like offloading $10 million is not worth that in the modern climate. So one part of it is how will that change? And I guess it could change by teams that were deeper in not wanting to be that way. That could change, but there aren't that many of them. We kind of know why they're there. Like, you know, maybe it could be something like Boston. They just, you know, it'd be better for them if they could shed one of the $10 million players and anything like that. Also, generally speaking, those teams don't have a lot of guys that are simultaneously expensive and not important. Like mm-hmm. that's the silver bullet when it comes to like cap space trades. It's like this guy's making $15 million and he's not in our closing five. Or like, you know, Boston's situation's a little bit different. Like they could never be in our closing five. Like there are times Brogdon and all these other Derek White and all that. It'll work out.
Sure.
And so like those sorts of circumstances can't happen. And that was kind of the way that it could occur. But there aren't that many of those right now. But so like what I was thinking about is, well, how is this going to change? And I think the place to start, as you brought up, is with the extension system. And so part of the reason why the free agent classes are so bad is that these players are extending rather than waiting. And full credit to them. I mean, like a lot of them, you know, like every once in a while there'll be somebody who I'm sure they wish they hit free agency or that they hit free agency instead, and that's fine. But generally speaking, I think it's working out. So the two ways that can change is, so from the team side, teams could become more reluctant to sign, especially non-premium players, to extensions. Like, we're seeing a lot of these, you know, like John Conchar and Kenrich Williams, or, you know, like Lou Dortz wasn't an extension, but in many ways it kind of was, because they didn't have to do it when they did it, or Jayshon Tate. So teams could get more reluctant. They're saying like, hey, we're committing a lot of money. Maybe that would be some of those unnecessary deals turning sour. Or like the one that I used for a long time was like De'Aaron Fox. Like De'Aaron Fox getting a 25% max a year early. I like De'Aaron Fox. I liked him then, but it was like, does he have the equity to say like, I'm going to do this? But the counterpoint is like, he probably would have gotten an offer sheet in that range anyway. Mm-hmm. So one is from the team perspective. The other, and this is where I think it actually changes, is from the player perspective. And the reason there is the new national TV deal, where, I mean, I don't think what changes in the cap is going to be as extreme as what happened in 16. But, and I was stunned that we didn't see more of this year, that the incentives are, we don't know how they're going to shift, but we know they're going to shift. And like, so if I were advising players right now, I would say it's better to sign a shorter term contract if you can get out in 25 or 26 than like, so from a player perspective, if you're good and you think your value will hold at least reasonably, don't think of a 3-year deal as significantly worse than a 5-year deal.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's going to be two big things that could change the way these extensions work. And one you hit on for sure is the new TV money. I think we may see, much like we saw a few years back, we may see some guys look at it and say, yeah, I'm going to do a little shorter because I know and have confidence that my value will hold, that I can still get a max and get you know, that massive, massive amount of money. I think the other thing that I'm very curious to see, because I think there's just so much going on around it, and hearing Adam Silver mention it several times over the last couple years really, is what happens with trade requests and demands, an ability to trade players. Are they going to tweak something in this next CBA where if you sign a 4-year deal, there's no trade for years one or two, or something like that? Is it? And I'm wildly speculating here. I'm not, I have no idea. But is there going to be something like that put in to the CBA that makes players a little less likely to say, I don't know if I want to lock in for 5 years then. Maybe I'll do 2 years or 3 years or something like that. And does that kind of re-energize the free agent market year over year, because guys aren't necessarily looking to lock in for so many years? Those are the two kind of combinations of things that I'm really interested to see what changes there. I feel really confident we're not going to see a massive cap spike like what we saw in 2016, because I think everybody realized all that does is get one free agent class massively overpaid, and then everybody else kind of falls into line later. But I do think the cap is going to continue to go up and up and up, where I do think we may see some guys say, yeah, it's not a spike where it goes up by 20 or 30 million, but it's enough that I'm going to start planning here in the next year or two to make sure I'm, whether it's I'm directly a free agent or I have some sort of option that I can get out of my deal and be a free agent and do that. And I think we may see some teams do that as well, where we may see, probably not on the max guys, because it's super duper rare that we see anything like this happen, but on those kind of mid-range guys where, all right, you're going to make between 15 and 20 million, we're going to make that last season either a team option or some form of partial or non-guarantee, so that way we can have a little bit of flexibility if we want to play in the free agent market when everything expands greatly.
It's a great point. And from the team perspective, I mean, you could even look at, well, none of the contracts worked out the way they hoped. Like, the Knicks got out of the contracts that they signed over the last couple of years that didn't work out super well pretty cleanly. Like, it didn't take too much to get off of Noel and Burks and even Kemba. Like, the Kemba deal, like, it depends on how you assess. They gave up a lot to get rid of Kemba, but if you think about all the Pistons deals as being connected loosely, like, maybe it was the, like, hey, if we need this for you, let us know. Like, that sort of thing would be notable. But so, like, and it's also worthwhile that Evan 48 did not get traded, so that was probably a little harder. They gave him an extra year. You know, he had leverage. He was a better player and all that. But so, yeah, I think there really is something to it. And I agree with you that the spike, if that the increase will not come in the form of a spike, because the constituency for it is going to be a little bit different, and now everybody knows that that's going to work. I think what happened mm-hmm. last time, as I've heard parts of it, is that the way the proposal that the owners gave to mitigate the spike was so owner friendly that the players are just like, no. And I think that both sides have learned from that, that the owners need to make a better offer, and then the players have, as you said it, like, you know, it gets certain players rich, it doesn't do others. But I
think, too, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I think one thing that's really important is the players and owners, whether that be Adam Silver and Tamika, I think it's Tremaglio, I think is how you say it. But the head of the Players Association, that relationship is now far better than it was back the first time around.
Right.
Where now they have that faith of, hey, we're working on this together. I like to say we're trying to figure out a way to split this big old watermelon between us versus trying to split a grape between us anymore. Like now we've got this thing, and it's, you know, hey, if we split it right down the middle, which largely, you know, in very layman's terms, that's roughly what happens, we're all going to be pretty good. But let's make sure we're taking care of all, you know, 500 players versus taking care of the, you know, 50 to 100 real meaningful free agents in 1 year. And I think that's different. I also think, you know, it's awful that we had to go that way to get there, but working through three pandemic impacted seasons together to make sure everybody was taken care of the best way they could, and everybody still got paid and the cap went up more than any of us could have projected this year, that's all stuff that leads me towards they're going to work together on this versus working against each other this time around.
Yeah. It's the negotiation having a different tenor is extremely important, because, as you said, it's dividing up a really big pie, and that's both easier to do, but also difficult, because, like, I think in some ways the PA part of it is harder than the league versus PA part of it now, and so mm-hmm. like that and. That in many ways is easier to negotiate, but like the structure of everything. And yeah, as you brought up previously, are there going to be some tweaks in terms of when a player can and cannot be traded? We know that with these Supermax deals, you have a year restriction, but there are a lot of other wrinkles where you don't, where it's more like half a year or something else. And there could be some potential solutions there. Players aren't going to want restrictions on movement. But the other thing that I'm extremely encouraged by is it's unlikely, as I see it, that there's going to be a lockout or, yeah. I mean, it could be a strike, because these issues are so much more solvable, especially with the amount of time they have to solve them, than the we need a lot more money than we're getting, because that's what leads to lockouts and strikes. And mm-hmm. basketball, like, I think they can, even though, I mean, for me, at some point, the players, like, quote unquote, they deserve to, I thought it was more fair when they had the portion of the pie that they did before a couple CBAs ago. But I think the point with it is, like, yeah, that's probably true. Like, I'm sure the players would rather have 54, 55% than the 50, 51 they have now, but it's still a whole lot of money. And is it worth losing half a season or a whole season for it? Especially when the general understanding is that lockouts end up working out for owners instead of players because they're richer. Like, that's just the way yep. it works out. So I think that I'm optimistic about that. And the rule of new CBAs is that there will always be unintended consequences. They'll always try to pull up ladders and they'll leave down other ladders. And that's just the way this always works. And that's never going to change. But I am, for me, the big question that is looming, and I think part of why it hasn't happened yet is because we don't know, is people like us talked about 2016 coming years ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And roughly speaking, that's going to be 25. It could be 26, depending on how all this stuff shakes out. Because the new television deal isn't negotiated, because the new CBA isn't negotiated, we're dealing with it as this looming thing that we don't know. And I think that's how the players and their agents are, and teams are seeing it too. Like, you know, the way we're... But I think what's going to be fascinating over time is that, for me, Ayton is a great example here. So it seems like a part of the awkwardness, the acrimony in those negotiations was the Suns not wanting to give Ayton a fifth year.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that in normal circumstances, that is a reasonable approach, especially if you think that Ayton's contract is more in lines of properly paid than underpaid, because theoretically, if you're underpaying a guy, this is what's going on with the Cavs and Sexton right now, reportedly. If you think a guy's being underpaid, you want to pay him for as long as you can. mitigating risk if you need to. But if you think a guy's overpaid or properly paid, you probably want to shorten it up to get to mitigate the risk for you. So with Ayton, there's this idea that the Suns kind of, and presumably this came from Sarver, wanted to, a four-year deal for them was more preferable than a five-year deal. And I'm not the biggest Ayton fan. I think that he, I appreciate the improvement that he's made, but when you think that that fifth year would be the 26-27 season, getting him locked in for, let's call it $36 million a year, I think fighting that as a war instead of it being like a more fluid preference might end up looking like a mistake, because it might be like, well, crap, like that's league, that's like the 12th starting center in the league money rather than like the fifth starting center in the league money.
Yeah, I think so, and I'm with you on that too, because I think the other challenge is you're also looking at it and saying, well, what do we have on the books and what are we likely to have on the books that year? And now we know now they have Devin Booker extended. It, right now that projects to be about $58 million, which even still looking at some of these numbers, even as often as I do, it still takes me a minute to, is that right? Did I make a typo there? Because we're now single season salaries, you know, $50-60 million. But then that's it. Now, even if you project and say, all right, well, Mikal Bridges, we'll probably try to keep him around too. We'll be there. I think that's probably going to be post Chris Paul at this point, but it, you know, more likely than not. So then, all right, well, we'll probably replace that. But to your point, you start looking at that and saying, all right, well, what will that number be? Well, when we get there, it, you know, are we Devin Booker locked into this kind of salary at $58 million? That seems almost kind of absurd right now. That's just such a big number. But that might be the fifth or sixth highest paid shooting guard by the time we actually get to that season. That could be where we're at. And that's where I think this year really instructional was people overreacted and went crazy about Jalen Brunson was going to make $25 million average annual salary. I believe that would have placed him between 12 and 15 of point guard salaries this year. And if you look at it, I think it's reasonable to say Jalen Brunson, maybe a top 15 point guard in the NBA. You know, you might have him a little lower. Maybe some people have him a little higher. But I don't think it's absurd when you start looking at it in that context. And that's where I get sticker shock too when I see some of these reported deals. But then I try to go back and I try to look and place it into, all right, where does this fall in the overall context of position, of team, of makeup, of what was available this offseason? Well, what pressure are they under? Those kind of things. And more often than not, I find myself coming back and saying, yeah, the player did pretty good. But you know what? The team did pretty good here too.
I agree. And there will be a shift. I don't know when. So I think it's going to be when the money actually kicks in. And so like these teams have become so comfortable giving out like 4 and 5 year extensions. And then what's going to happen is at some point, you know, the money's going to keep rolling in and all that. I don't know when it's going to be. It might even be like 28. It's going to be a long way out where it's like, oh no, like that might not have been the best idea, but it's going to be. But again, those chickens aren't going to come home to roost for a while. And this is something I talked about with Nate when we were doing off season grades. There's like, so when we were talking about before about like the like signing extensions and what could change it, is another reason why teams have been aggressive signing these extensions is that even when some of them have turned, let's say, more negative, generally speaking, the team that inked that extension has not been the one that suffered. So the best example for me with that is Russell Westbrook.
Yep.
Russell Westbrook signed an extension that turned sour, but the team that suffered those consequences was like the third set of hands that touched him after that extension. And Westbrook is an extreme, of course, not only in terms of how quickly it turned, but in terms of how many times he changed teams beforehand. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. But you can think of like Rudy Gobert. And so the shorthand that I've been using, which is not what I would use if a team gave me the reins and I was a general manager, is if a player's contract looks reasonable for the coming year and ideally the next year, teams just don't really care beyond that. Like, that is pretty much the way this works. Like, so I talked about this when the Rudy Gobert trade happened. It's like Gobert, you know, 30 years old. And so, right, but he's, you know, defensive player of the year caliber. He's, I like to refer to as a heliocentric defender, where like he can be your system. And that is incredibly valuable, especially in the regular season. So paying him, you know, $38 million for next year, $41 million for the year after that, it's high, but it's also reasonable. Like, it's in the reasonable range, if as long as he stays healthy, which he has. You know, $43 million, $47 million after that, we'll see. But I don't think Minnesota really cared too much about that. And you could go through various contracts over the last couple of years. And so from a team perspective, you think, okay, as long as we're smarter than the teams we're negotiating with, as long as we know that player better than they do, we'll be okay. And so that makes them more comfortable taking on the risk of a big deal.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it is. I think what you said of teams looking at these extensions as almost a, for us, this is the next couple years, then you just have to be right and you have to be ready to move the minute you're like, it's starting to turn a little bit. You just have to be ready to go if that's, you know, where it is. Now, even if Danny Ainge felt that way on Rudy Gobert, let's say the Jazz made it to the West Finals and pushed the Warriors to seven games or something, maybe we don't see a Rudy Gobert trade, because sure, maybe then it becomes a little easier to say, the deal might be turning, but I can't tear this down now. Fans will have my head if I do that, because we are right there. And that's where, again, it kind of goes, it's tough, because I think the Jazz could have brought Rudy Gobert back. They could keep Donovan Mitchell, keep the basic tenets of their team. They probably would have been fourth, fifth, sixth in the West again. And they probably could have been that for the next 3 years. I think it's that saying, that's not where we want to be. That's a little bit harder than saying, we're 7, 8, 9, 10. You know, that's far easier, because nobody really wants to be that.
Right.
But when you're fourth, fifth, you start looking at it and saying, all right, well, you know, one team in front of us has that season where the wheels come off injury-wise. And then one other team just isn't as good as everybody thought. Now we're right there. And then one injury, and now we're there. You know, we're playing for a title that we didn't necessarily expect. But I think it is, you know, good from Utah's perspective to look at that and say, yeah, it's not, you know, we've done this now. This was year, what, 3, 4, 5 of this, you know, where we're going to go. And I see, you know, unfortunately, I can see a couple other teams maybe hitting that point where, like, the team I'm kind of curious about where they go moving forward is Dallas, because I think Dallas has maybe a little bit painted themselves into somewhat of a corner here. Luka is great. Pay him, you know, I know he's getting the max, but you could have paid him twice that and I would have been fine with it. But what gets tricky, I think, is you get locked in with a couple other guys. Now you're in a position where Maxi Kleber needs paid. Mm-hmm. Christian Wood needs paid. You're already paying Tim Hardaway Jr. for a couple years. You start to get into a position where, all right, that's great. Pay all those guys if you're in the West Finals or if you're pushing for a title. But if you're sitting around the middle of the conference again, and where are we going with this? Because then it starts to be, all right, we locked Luke into a bunch of guys who are good, but they're not quite good enough for the next few years. And that's where you start to see players, I think, attitude starts to become, what are we doing here? Where are we going? Because I don't want to be fourth, fifth every year. I want to be first, second. I want to be fighting to get into the finals each season. And that's where, you know, that's where it gets very, very hard, because I get it. If you're Dallas, you got Christian Wood for nothing. A bunch of players who were expiring contracts and it's not there. But I do wonder, would you have been better off without that question? If Christian Wood is just Christian Wood again, that's in the new market, that's a probably $17, $18 million player. And is that the best decision for the Mavericks, knowing what else they have on their books? I don't know. I'm just not necessarily sold that that's where they should go. But that's what makes it interesting, is you have all these teams looking at it and they're all kind of prioritizing different things as far as, well, we do think this is where it can go. And maybe that is what they needed to lift them, you know, one more step beyond where they were. We're going to find out. But I'm just, you know, that's what I've got my eyes on, is where are we going with this?
That made me think of what I think is kind of the thing we can end on, which is so essential. And it's, you're tying back to the very beginning of this, we talked about how front offices are generally better run. And you brought up a couple of different teams and where they are. Is that not exclusively, but by and large, I think front offices are doing a better job of self-evaluation than they were before. And self-evaluation is so important. And like you brought up, I mean, it's easier in some ways for a team like the Jazz that was just living there. You know, like they, so Utah won, if we're counting full seasons, because there was, of course, an abbreviated season, they won 48 or more games for six consecutive years going into this offseason. That's a lot. But also, they never made the conference finals. So like you see, you can see how those things run together. And La Murray had this great thing about teams that like are in the mix that many times and then don't break through, which was very interesting. Mm-hmm. But so
yeah, that was like, good.
So you have, but generally speaking, and I, you know, we brought the Spurs before, we brought the Jazz, and I mean, and teams that I've criticized, you know, like I've the Bulls over the last couple of years, a few others, and the Bulls are better than I thought they were, to their immense credit, especially with DeRozan playing so well. The idea, because remember, you're not, you don't get to play out the season and find out where you actually would have been. You have to kind of see where it is and make your best guess and everything else. And so I think that it's not perfect, but teams being better at saying, okay, this isn't a playoff caliber team. And I mean, the one that I always hammered was Olshay with the Blazers, where they made a conference finals, but they weren't a top four team in the league. And then they kind of kept it together, and then they never got back there again. And now they're in a different phase, and things are, you know, I'm actually pretty happy with the offseason they had. But there are a lot of ways to be wrong there, and typically it's being too optimistic, where you see the things that went well for you the previous year as signal, and the things that didn't go well as unrepeatable noise. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, we had some injuries. We're not going to have those injuries this year. Player X had a wonderful second half and had a bad first half. So it's all the second half. That's the only thing that matters. And so I think that it helps, and it leads to a better distribution. But what's fun about that is I think that there is a better distribution. And I think that this, you know, that is a real lesson from these last couple of years. However, those evaluations, my instinct is, are going to be really hard this year, especially with the teams coming back from injury, because especially in the Western Conference, the bars to like defining success are going to be so incredibly high.
Yeah, I use the Grizzlies as my test case for that last part, where I say regularly, Memphis might be just as good, and they might be fifth next year in the West, just because there's going to be so many good teams, and they may win 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 less games than they did, but play almost just as well. It's just, you know, Clippers are going to be better. Denver's probably going to be better. Like, these teams are going to be better, and that's where you know, I think it's hard. I feel like for so many years, the league was divided into, here's the maybe four teams realistically can win the title. Then here's a team of a tier of about maybe 10 teams that are kind of in the mix if everything goes right or something goes wrong with one of those other four. Then there's a whole bunch of teams that are, they're a mess and they're rebuilding and they're awful. And now I feel like it's more of, all right, well, even the rebuilding teams like Oklahoma City, Orlando, Detroit, Houston, those teams are, they're probably going to be bad record wise, but they're, you can see it now. You can see we're probably only another year or two away from that starting to come to fruition a little bit more of, you know, what are they really going to be? And that's where I find a team like Sacramento interesting, because by the time they're finally ready to maybe be something, and they've caught the Portlands and the Lakers and some of those teams, are they going to have been surpassed by the Oklahoma Cities and the Rockets and those sorts of teams? And are they going to be kind of forever still stuck where they were? That's where it gets so hard to do that. But it is what, you know, that balance, like you said, that's what really, or that redistribution, that's what makes the league, you know, really fun right now, is because you've got 30 teams that are all, you can kind of look at it. There's no teams I'm looking at and saying, oh yeah, they're exactly like this team. Where I really like Major League Baseball, and it felt like they went through a period of time in baseball where you had 25 teams that were being run almost the exact same way. And it got really boring because it was like, I don't want to watch 25 of the same versions of teams. I want to see different teams. That's why I loved Cleveland last year, saying, you know what, we're going to play 3 7-footers because we're going to play 3 7-footers with 2 6-foot-2 guards. And we're going to see where it goes. I think that's what makes basketball a lot of fun, is when the teams all do take different approaches and different styles, whether it be to their roster, style of play, or whatever it is. That's when it really but comes in a point where, all right, this is really fun because now I'm seeing something different in every single game and matchup and those kind of things, versus watching five teams that are, or you know, 25 teams rather, that are built exactly the same and playing the exact same kind of style of basketball. That just gets very boring to me.
I agree. And teams also being emboldened and seeing the success of the Cavs and numerous other ones to say there are a lot of different ways to succeed. I mean, the Nuggets with Jokic, like that is a very different approach than we've seen before. And that's a part of what, I mean, I didn't watch basketball as a kid, but a part of what made me gravitate towards it later is that part what makes basketball so fun is that you will get a lot from your star players, but there are a lot of different ways to succeed and a lot of different ways to fail. Mm-hmm. And if the more that's true to me, the more things can be tried. And I mean, we're going to get an awesome test case there with Minnesota this year of, you know, like going in kind of an extended version of the theory, not just because their players are taller, but because Towns and Gobert are both all NBA caliber players right now. And like that, so that's a fundamentally different question. And I'm super excited about that. And part of what makes the upcoming, the 22-23 season so much fun is I like to think about a basketball year in phases. And so you have like the early regular season, the mid, late regular season, and then you have the playoffs as kind of different elements. So you have like the early rounds, which can be like the sorting, and you get to see how some of these young teams are working out, and then you get into like the real meat of it, like the teams that actually have a shot. And knowing what we know right now, and inevitably injuries will shift this, all of those phases are really fun. Like I always love the first, because the first is figuring out what in the world these teams are and everything else like that. But the playoff races this year are going to be probably very wild. I mean, especially in the West, but in both conferences, like there are going to be some absolutely nasty first round series if things work out the way that we think they do. Like just two really good teams, because there are more than four in each conference going at it, and the incentives there, and there could be multiple, like, I mean, especially with how the West might be looking. And then you get into the later stuff, which is always going to be fun because it's the best of the best going at it. And so be all of like that. And that's not true every season. Like, I mean, that was my biggest disappointment, you could call it, of the KD Warriors years, was oftentimes the last phase wasn't that interesting because we kind of, one team was way better than everyone else and they didn't win every championship when he was there. But I think this year, especially for those of us who are also looking forward at the same time, not that you need to have fun with this year, it's going to be a lot to take in.
Yeah, they're very, I don't even know that there's a single team. And it's easy to say this here in the beginning of August, because I already miss it. I can't wait for it to come back. But there's not a team I'm looking at right now and saying, yeah, I just don't really have a lot of interest in watching them anymore. That will come. There will be a team, you know, by the trade deadline or something where I'm like, yeah, there's just not really anything left to learn here. I don't have a lot of interest in that team. But right now, even the bad teams, they're young, they're interesting. Those teams, I'm super excited to see what they grow into. It feels like there's, you know, five, six teams on each side, each conference, that are really look like they could be good and really be a team that could make that deep playoff run. So I'm absolutely with you on that one. I found it very boring, I think, kind of like you, when it was at the beginning of the year, all right, well, we know it's going to be Warriors Cavs in the end, so what are we doing all the rest of this for? It feels like almost like I know what happens at the end of this movie, but you know, am I gonna watch all the rest of it? And then I almost felt gross, because you start rooting for reasons for, well, maybe something will happen and it won't be that. And you, on the positive side, you start, maybe this team will be great that I didn't expect to be this good, and they'll overtake one of those two teams. But more realistic, it's like, maybe somebody will turn an ankle in game five of a first round series, and then, you know, it'll become more interesting than what it was going to be. And that's, I don't ever want to be that way. I never want to have that, you know, looking for interest in that way. So I'm glad right now looking at it, I'm looking at it and saying, yeah, you could tell me 8, 9, 10 teams might win the title this year, and I might say, yeah, that's right. You'd also tell me on the flip side, these 8, 9, 10 teams, they could be in the mix for the number and overall pick, and I'd be like, yeah, that could happen too. And that's, I think that's a great place for the league to be, you know, overall health wise. And I think that reflects in the fact that people are watching, people are going to games. It's part of why the cap is going up and all those other things. I think all that stuff is a sign of just how healthy this league is.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great place to end it. So thank you so much for coming on.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Keith Smith for taking the time to come on. You can read his work at Spotrac, at Celtics Blog. You can listen or watch the Front Office show that he does. And you can also follow him on Twitter at KeithSmithNBA, KeithSmithNBA. Love having him on. And as I believe I alluded to this on the podcast, Keith and I have known each other personally for years. I actually was his editor for a couple things when was working on the CBA Encyclopedia project for Real GM. He took over some parts of that project, did a great job, and I was editing. Of course, we also were just colleagues there for a really long time, and we've known each other personally for a lot of that as well. So great to put him on the pod. I really enjoyed where it went, and I thought it was a very thoughtful conversation. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, whatever podcast player you use, Spotify, Apple, whatever. Really do appreciate that. Helps you find the show. It's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. And then you can also help other people find the show, and that's through leaving a rating or review, through word of mouth, really whatever helps other people find it. Real GM Radio has been around a long time, but I really do appreciate it. And then the most important thing you can do for this show and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. For us, that is betonline.ag. Use that CLNS50 promo code to get yourself a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit and to tell them that you came from us, which benefits us because then they will keep advertising on this fair podcast. You can also check out my other work. Nate Duncan and I are still doing both Dunked On Prime, and the Spotify live show, which is called Duncan and LaRue. Those will keep going. The big general rule with Spotify is going to be, as long as both of us are in the country, we will do it. So there will be a stretch later on in the off season where I will be gone, so we'll probably take those weeks off, and then Dunked On Prime is still going to go strong. He's going to get into the 50 division, or not division, team podcasts with his people. I was going into the next thing I was going to promo, which is that the division capsule series is what I call it, where I typically have two guests on and we go through what happened in a division. It looks like that's going to start next week, and then that is going to carry through my vacation, and that's going to be, and I might sprinkle in some other stuff, just depending on how the timing works. I'm ironing out the dates and the times of those as this week rolls on. So should be a lot of fun stuff there, great guests, and some really thoughtful conversations. We're running into a little bit of awkwardness due to the prolonged Kevin Durant and Donovan Mitchell thing. Some people want to push back, and I'm kind of like, well, we're going to have to see. Well, those things might linger a little bit. So we'll square all that up over the next little bit. If you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will read it. That is a promise. I will try to respond, but my promise is to read it. That's why it's feedback. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.